Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This podcast exists because of the paid support from members at DecodingTV.com. Get ad-free episodes and early access to episodes by becoming a paid member at DecodingTV.com. Thanks to everyone at DecodingTV.com who makes this show possible.
What makes you happy is other people being happy. So the gift is their faces when we tell them about this. And the model home is a kind of a memory of that feeling.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I'm David Chen, and my gift is the smile on my co-host's faces when I'm recording a podcast with them. Joining me today, he has been my valiant co-host during this entire series of Curse episodes, Patrick Lepik.
I'm trying to hold on to the memory of the feeling I had before I watched the finale of the show.
And also joining us, a very special guest and also my frequent co-host on This Week in Streaming. You've seen her work as Jessie Gender on YouTube, Jessie Earle.
Hello. I just want to ask both of you, is my baby belly in shot right now? Can you see it?
All right. Today on Decoding TV, we're going to be discussing the season finale, probably series finale, if we're all being honest, of The Curse, which is streaming right now on Showtime Paramount Plus. You can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. Find us across all platforms at Decoding TV. We are going to start by talking about our overall reaction to the finale and then move into a detailed spoilery recap. But before we do that, a couple of quick announcements. I mentioned as I recorded the show with Patrick last week that in the weeks to come, we're going to be shifting Decoding TV to a weekly format. Stay tuned the next few weeks. There's going to be a lot of stuff we're going to be covering on the podcast, including True Detective. I know Patrick Lepik's super psyched about that. You should expect to hear some coverage of Echo, Masters of the Air. So it's all going to be happening on Decoding TV. Just keep it tuned in at podcast.decodingtv.com. There are a few follow-ups, a few emails we got at decodingtv@gmail.com that I thought it might be nice to address before we get to today's episode. First of all, I wanted to make a note of the music on The Curse, the show. Like, we hadn't really talked too much about it, Patrick. But there are multiple scenes in The Curse of people sitting in cars singing along to the music that's playing in the car. And in particular, there's a scene where Emma Stone's character, Whitney, is singing Robin's Dancing on My Own, which is a very appropriate song for her because I think that's how she – you know, people sing the songs that represent how they see themselves, basically, right? Dancing on My Own, by the way, has been added to my regular rotation playlist after I watched this performance.
You never heard – oh, that's one of my all-time favorite.
Oh, it's a great song. I've heard it before, but I was just like – I subscribe to Apple Music and they have the Beatles Essentials and Robin Essentials. And so like I added Robin Essentials to like my regular rotation.
She has so many bangers.
Yeah, like, she has so many bangers.
A ton of great tracks.
I've been teaching myself how to play poker recently. I go to play poker and I'm just like listening to Robin's dancing on my own and repeat. It's on my poker playlist. So anyway, and then there was also a scene where Nathan Fielder and Benny Safdie rapped Dead Prez's Hell Yeah, which was highly enjoyable for a variety of reasons. Because suitably, very appropriately, they don't use the N-word. They just say N-word, literally the phrase N-word instead of the actual N-word.
Would kill to see the dailies from that shot.
Must have been an interesting day to shoot.
It's a conundrum these days, you know, many white people, none present company excluded, I'm sure, have with rapping songs that have the N-word in them. And I don't know that there's any good solution for it other than not saying anything when that word comes up. But I feel like the solution they came up with is just fine. I don't know. I don't know if you guys had any thoughts on that. I was just like, oh, like I, David Chen, I don't sing along to raps in general. And so I've never come up to that, you know, problem.
I can't memorize anything, so I'm safe. I'm safe from this problem.
I can't sing at all.
I did grow up in the 90s, and I'll say that's not the policy most white people had in the 90s.
That is correct. No. Wow. Patrick Klepek continues his description of his 90s crime spree.
I told you I can't memorize things, David. Do not put this on me. I'm just speaking to the culture. I will admit to my crimes. Although I'm not sure I would admit to that one.
Yeah. Agreed. Anyway, it's funny because obviously that's how those characters, you know, I think to some degree that's how Asher sees himself in the show, right? Yeah, I just think the music is a really interesting window into the character. So I wanted to give that a shout out. Okay, we got a couple emails at decodingtv@gmail.com. Let's start with this email about Jimmy Buffett. Andrew writes in to decodingtv@gmail.com talking about our discussion of episode 9. I'm not going to read the whole email, but he says, quote, "When Whitney went to talk to her parents, her dad was wearing a Grateful Dead t-shirt. I'm not a big fan of theirs, but it says something about how he sees himself." And then Andrew goes into this whole description about how he used to be really into Jimmy Buffett's music.
Incredible story.
And then he says, quote, "Eventually I saw Jimmy Buffett in concert and it was a cringe fest. He was fine, but it was the crowd that got to me. I was younger than his core audience and just saw old white guys wearing Aloha shirts and inflatable parrots on their heads. Looking at these people, I just thought most of these guys are probably corporate scumbags and shills during the day and try to come off with their costumes as relaxed guys who just like to have a fun time. The show was at MSG, which is not a big tropical paradise. I wore one of many Aloha shirts too. After the show, I stopped listening to Jimmy Buffett's music for the most part, though a few of his songs I actually like, but was done trying to force myself to be a big fan. The Aloha shirts also went a bit deeper in my closet, except for when going on cruises or vacations. I know this is long-winded and rambling, but this is how I saw Whitney's dad, and it made me cringe. Even though it wasn't a Buffett t-shirt, I know the vibe her dad was going for and cringed when I saw it. Also, Asher was definitely pulling his little putt in the bathroom."
I agree.
Anyway, lovely email about how, like, just like a simple choice of which t-shirt this guy's wearing might tell you how that character sees himself, you know? So, yeah. Any Jimmy Buffett fans on the podcast right now?
No, but you're reminding me.
I hope someone raises their hand. It's all I want right now is someone to admit to that.
Jesse Earl?
Oh, it just reminds me of a terrible, traumatic moment. Where I was in the Bahamas for like a business thing that I was at. And the people, like, instead of like actually going to like an actual restaurant, people were like, "Wouldn't it be funny if you went to Margaritaville?" And so we go to Margaritaville, and it's the most uncomfortable feeling I've ever had because I'm just in the Bahamas at a Margaritaville, and it felt like the most capitalist thing I've ever done in my life. It was horrible. But then there was a Bohemian band that started playing around us, so we couldn't talk. So we're all just sitting there listening to an actual Bohemian band play around us at a Margaritaville in the middle of the Bahamas. And I was like, I feel like the worst person in the world right now.
Fair. Sometimes you are confronted with the full extent of America's colonialist tendencies.
Yeah, it was like all right there. And I'm like, great. I'm glad I'm here. This is wonderful for me.
All right. Thanks for that email from Andrew. I wanted to read this email from Curtis, and this is a good way to lead into our conversation about our overall thoughts on the episode. Curtis writes in to decodingtv@gmail.com. "Hey, David and Patrick, I've enjoyed your coverage of The Curse. I love The Curse, or at least I loved it at the beginning. I thought the growing tension indicated writing that would lead to one of the greatest seasons of television, one of the great seasons of television. However, I'm starting to feel a little bit of Lost syndrome. Like the television show Lost. The show opens up more threads than it closes. It's not as tight as I thought it would be 90% of the way through. The concept and main thread of the titular curse often seems to get forgotten. I hope that this would be one of the best seasons, some of the best seasons of Arrested Development, The Sopranos, Succession, Fargo, and others. A classic season of bleak comedy television. After watching episode 9, I now believe there is a more than 90% chance the ending will be more like Lost or Leave the World Behind, an escalation of tension that disappointingly leads to a fart of an ending and then nothing. I hope I am wrong. Does any part of you feel the same way? End quote. Well, let's get into it, folks.
Well, okay, so is this where I start my 90-minute defense of the ending of Lost and that people just misinterpreted how that show went along and it was about the characters all along?
Thank you, thank you. I am also a huge
fan of the Lost
finale.
Have I found a fellow traveler in this?
Yes, yes. I will defend.
Oh, I'm sorry you were
ending.
Watching a different show and tricked yourself into it. Ooh, the marketing like made me think it wasn't a show about the character. Jack and his dad. Anyway, sorry.
All right, well, putting aside your feelings about Lost, let's substitute in place of Lost, substitute in any other show that you feel didn't stick the landing, right?
Uh-huh.
So do we feel like maybe the finale is going to drop some threads that were seeded earlier this season? Patrick Klepek, what do you think?
So is this my overall thoughts on the finale?
Before we get to yes.
Okay.
I do want to say one thing. We are recording this show immediately after like the show has aired. It's live now. It's going out to decodingtv.com shortly after it's aired. And so I assume that there's going to be some discourse, some explanation, some theorizing about the show that we do not have access to. And I will tell you this. We have not heard a peep from Showtime publicists all season. I assume they're thrilled with our coverage of the show from a week-to-week basis. We did get one email.
I was going to say, we got one email.
One email this week saying, hey, the Curse finale is airing this week. Do not say shit about what happens in that finale, please.
It's like four lines that are just like a fancy way of saying shut the fuck up.
Yeah, do not say anything about what happens in the finale, please. Okay, so before it airs, of course. So now it has aired. We are talking about it. Basically what I'm saying is I feel like there's going to be a lot of conversation about the finale. We have not experienced that conversation as of recording this podcast. So all that being said, Patrick Klepek, what do you think of the finale?
I love a big swing. I do. I do. And I think the most generous reading of the Curse of the Season finale is that it is deeply memorable. You will not forget that you watched the season finale to the curse. Impossible. It's staring you in the face. It's grabbing you.
Which, by the way, is more than you can say for, I'm going to say, 70 to 80% of shows.
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. And commitment to a bit in Nathan Fielder fashion, it's here. I get the bit. Like, are we done with this? Oh, we're not. Okay. So, long story short, I did not care. Essentially, I loved the first 20 minutes. And then there's a moment that we'll get to in spoilers where something really fundamental shifts in sort of the nature of the show. And it really did almost nothing for me. I just highly disliked that we just kind of lost all the threads on the characters. I don't really feel like it builds up to something. I can easily see how people are going to find a way to see a thematic thread. I can see a thematic thread, but
people, you mean one of your co-hosts here on this
yeah,
podcast.
And I'm not going to disagree with you on probably that was the intention. I guess where I landed or didn't. What
I was going to make that
nailed it.
No one else
nailed it.
It just absolutely did not work for me, which is strange because I think as an episode of television, I think it is thrilling and interesting and bold and exciting. As a season finale to the show that I watch, I think it is more or less a failure. And I found that really frustrating for the show that I thought I was watching up until this point. And that's kind of where I ended on it.
I feel exactly the same way. In literally the way you just put it, that's how I phrased it in my head before we started recording was – if you just watched this one episode of television, you would think that's a pretty great episode of television, right? Like, that's pretty solid. There's really well done elements of that. But as a finale, it really doesn't sort of pay off a lot of what we have been building up to this season. Again, unless there's some really big ideas that we just completely missed, which I openly admit is possible. Jesse Earl, you know, Jesse did yeoman's work here because she, you know, I've been trying to make this like trio happen, the three of us podcasting together for weeks now. And, you know, I was throwing out ideas like, hey, you know, what's Patrick watching? What are you watching? Oh, maybe you can catch up with the curse. So Jesse watched basically the entire season over the course of the last like week or two just to catch up in time to be here for this podcast today. So she's got a very condensed experience of the curse.
To be fair, I was planning on watching it the very least. So
right. But this just made you speed up the process a little bit. Mm-hmm. So you have a little bit of different perspective in that you have compressed it all into a very short time period. What did you think of the finale?
I listening to both of you talk about it, I don't think I could say anything that I disagree with. But for me, it did hit, and I actually really, really love this finale quite a lot. Mostly because it does. I mean, we mentioned the Lost finale, and I know, Patrick, you like it as well as I do, but it kind of has that same vibe for me in that it kind of delivers on the thematic threads and the ideas that I wanted it to play with. And it just leaves me sort of sitting here wanting to discuss a lot of what this was attempting to do in a way that excites me. So I don't think, you know, just... I don't think I can disagree with either of you on anything that you said. And I think it really just comes down to a personal preference on whether it works for you or not, because I think none of us are going to really disagree on it being a big swing and it being incredibly memorable, which honestly, again, I think Patrick, you said it, it's like it is more than most shows do with their finales. They at least it didn't peter out. I'll give it that. And that was an unintended pun right there. Anyways.
Yeah, nice. Nailed it. I think I just want to add one other thing before we get to the detailed recap, which is this show is co-made by Benny Safdie and Nathan Fielder. Those are two people who, in my opinion, know how to end things well. Nathan, for you, ended with a like 90-minute finale called Finding Francis, which was very beautiful and touching and represented the best of what that show could do. The Rehearsal on HBO had one of the most haunting finales. I still think about those final shots of the finale of The Rehearsal, season one, and there's going to be season two apparently. So like, I think they understand. And of course, Uncut Gems, I thought, had an amazing ending. You know, the Safdie brothers worked on that. Good Time had a great ending. You know, like, they have made good endings before. I have to believe they know what a satisfying ending feels like, and they deliberately chose this for a reason. Mm-hmm. I don't think this was incompetence. You know what I mean? Like, maybe, like sometimes you watch a show and you feel as though things are going off the rails and these people don't have control of the characters or the storylines, and it just ends unsatisfyingly, and that's that. Like, and that feels like incompetence. This does not feel like incompetence, but it feels like they definitely made a choice that at least Patrick and I didn't really love. Jesse liked more. But yeah, I mean, we all, I think, admired it, right? We all admired it. And I agree with Patrick. I would much rather take a show that swings big and maybe misses or grazes the ball and it gets caught. It gets caught for a double play. You know, like the analogy is.
It's just fascinating because my wife is just starting to watch this show. She was finishing up the first episode not long after I'd watched the finale, and she said something to me as she was finishing it. She's like, "Where does this show go?" And I just stared into space for a little while because I didn't even know how. I was like at a loss for words. Like, I don't know what to tell you. And she's like, "Is that an endorsement?" And I said, "I don't know."
and you'd already seen the finale at that point, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. But if you are looking for, I will say, for as much as we're going to get into, and we'll get into it in detail, like what parts of it didn't, I found to be unsatisfying based on what I specifically wanted to be paid off in the finale. But again, you know, part of like why you started, you know, this entire project, David, why I wanted to like collaborate with you on it was like, you want to like, there's so much out there. How do you choose what to watch? And if part of your issue is it all kind of seems samey and I can't, it all feels like all operating at a similar, like vibe and like the curse is none of those things up in like even to its final shot. I have no qualms about having watched it. I would have some qualms about recommending it based on right. like how I think what kind of journey that person would go on. But if you like look at like this stranger era of TV, you're like nothing is sitting with me. Like this will sit with you. Like this will, and I do think that is, however I feel about what it decides to and not pay off, that's not nothing in an era where you can watch so much. And I would still highly recommend The Curse for people who are like looking for a particular style of show that will take them on a journey. Cause it does that. And I'm with you, David. I think it's a very confident finale. I just disagree with the choices. Like these are storytellers that from the jump, the reason you and I were so willing to go along with why are we on this tangent is like, well, these are smart people, and I think they made a smart ending. It's just a matter of, like Jesse said, where does it land for you thematically relative to the creative choices it makes?
Well, Patrick, I'm just going to rewind the tape on the podcast and note the many times where you said, hey, even if it doesn't go anywhere from here, this was worth it. Okay, yeah. So just get, you know, just gentle reminder, and I feel the same way. I feel the same way, but it has been a really, you know... I have really enjoyed the series of conversations we've had about this show, and great. This has not been the most popular show Decoding TV has covered, but the people who have stuck with us, I think, have been rewarded for it with some great conversations and some cool vibes. So those are our overall thoughts on the finale of The Curse.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So much more to discuss. Let's get into it. We opened the episode with a filming of an episode of Rachel Ray. There has been a massive time jump since the last episode. Green Queen is on the air, and Whitney is visibly pregnant. Any guesses as to how long it's been since the last episode?
But they had filmed, what, two episodes, three episodes? Like, we had only seen a fraction. David, I know you watch reality TV. Jesse, I don't know if you do. How long are reality show seasons, generally?
It depends on the channel, right?
Yeah, 10 to 13 episodes. But it's not clear to me that all the episodes, probably all of them are live. But Whitney is, like, visibly pregnant, so she's showing. So that means what? Second, third trimester, probably, right?
Yeah.
And the course of this episode seems to take place in a truncated period of time where like they're anticipating the labor coming any day now.
Oh, yeah. So. Yeah, that's right. She's definitely like in the final days of the.
My guess is 2 years, like at most, right? Like that would be.
One year, you know?
Yeah. But like a year and two. Yeah. Makes sense.
The biggest time jump we've had since the show began. And we open on Asher and Whitney guesting on an episode of Rachel Ray's cooking show where they're promoting the first season of their series. And what plays out is, I measured it, an 8-minute long clip of the Rachel Ray show where there's minutes go by and you don't even know why we are doing this. Like, and I texted Patrick, like, as you know, I sent Patrick a couple texts as I was watching the show, because he had a strong reaction to the finale. And so he texted me, and then I texted him back. I said, I admire the show's commitment. You know, any other show, some studio note would have said, hey, do we need to have 8 minutes of the Rachel Ray show uninterrupted at the beginning of the finale episode? And they would have gotten that note through. But not Nathan Fielder and Benny Safdie. They have enough juice that they're like, we want to show 8 minutes of Rachel Ray uninterrupted, and they were able to get it on the air.
Just in time for some Sopranos 25th anniversary, too, because the Sopranos actor is there as well.
Yes! Vincent Pastore, right? Is that what his name is? Yeah, Vincent Pastore, who plays Pussy Malenga on, or Pussy Bumpincero, Big Pussy Bumpincero on the Sopranos, they're promoting his cooking. I mean, Jesse, what was your reaction to this whole opening sequence?
Again, it kind of goes to what this whole episode is saying. I loved this. Like, this worked so well for me because the creepiness of just seeing them in the background smiling, just having that smile on for 8 full minutes, because they're mostly ignored. Like, they say a few things, and Rachel Ray sort of like comments on it, kind of like puts them down a little bit, and then keeps going with the show, and they just have to sit there smiling. And it just kind of goes to the whole vibe of this episode is just their characters, they just don't have any weight to them. No pun intended. Like, they work so hard to try and like have this impact and say we're changing lives, we're doing things, and no one cares, no one gives a crap. And like the most that she can get that Whitney can get out there is like, oh, maybe like have a timer to take shorter showers. Like, that's the only sort of piece of advice that Rachel Ray takes away from all of this like drama that we've been watching for, you know, 9 weeks at this point. So it's just it was just this very confident way of showing like they have no impact whatsoever in the way that they thought. They had this great sense of like meaning and self-worth, and it just means nothing to anybody that they gave a shit to talk to.
Yeah. One of my favorite moments in the episode is the smash cut from, you know, you're in Rachel Ray's crowd, and then smash cut to them like sitting in their house with the camera there.
Yeah.
And it's like dead quiet, and they're just smiling for minutes because that's what their experience of it is. Mm-hmm. It reminds me, honestly, of a TikTok that still haunts me to this day. Basically, like, there's a lot of influencers on TikTok. And, you know, I once saw a TikTok that was like, you know, this and that's how you make a green goddess dressing for your salad, you know. And then it cut to like a shot from like, you know, 10, like 8 feet away from that person, looking at that person, recording that. And just like turning off the camera and sighing and being alone in this big apartment by themselves. And I'll never forget that, of just like how what you see in front of the camera is like so different than the experience of making the stuff that you're making sometimes. Patrick Klepek, any thoughts on this Rachel Ray segment?
It was in a show that we have constantly praised for lingering, where shots go so much longer than is maybe even necessary, but the show makes it necessary because by having shots go a minute, 5 minutes longer than you would normally anticipate for the storytelling beat, it's creating its own sort of tension and world building like through that, like that process. This might have been my absolute favorite version of those because it's not us watching. I mean, there's a level of cringe here, certainly, as Jesse pointed out, like relative to the characters and the show they were trying to make and all that, but just sitting with this actual like fake version of a Rachel Ray episode for so long as like the camera goes away, like, all right, we're making meatballs. Oh, he's singing. There's some sexual tension. It's patently absurd conceptually for it to have gone on this long. And it's what
it's almost like a Tim and Eric sketch kind of.
It
like
really is. I was sort of expecting it to go fully awry at some point. Like, why are we sitting in this for so long? And it doesn't. But it invites you to question yourself, as the show often invites you to question yourself, because I think it just knows what it's doing. It is fundamentally aware that lingering in this show for this long is going to make the viewer go, why are we doing this?
It will make you question the nature of your reality, right?
Yes, and, yeah. And I adore it. It's part of why I thought this section of the episode is so strong, because it feels like the show, like you said, David, operating on all cylinders, where it's taking its own little version of reality, but then dropping it into a different version, like with camera cuts and like staging that we're probably familiar with, even if we don't watch shows like this. You've seen clips from it.
Yeah.
And watching those worlds intermingle and dance is just, I mean, it's just delightful. Like, yeah. I was upset when it was over. I was like, no, let's, is this, I mean, for a moment, I was like, is it possible?
Yeah.
Like,
the whole finale
is going to be a Rachel Ray episode. It was in the cards. Yes. Like, it was in the cards once we got past like minute 7.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Any of you have opinions on Rachel Ray, by the way? I actually have made several of her recipes before. I like, she was one of the people that helped me learn how to cook a little bit more, because her recipes are like really simple and accessible. So some people think that she's not, you know, there's some snobbishness in the food community, and some people think she might not be as refined and sophisticated, but I'm a fan. So it's good.
Whatever gets you to cook more. The gateway to getting into like cooking for yourself, how easy it is to make better meals for yourself, whatever gets you in that door. So, if, you know, for someone, it's Rachel Ray. Who cares?
Good to see Rachel Ray still getting work. You know, that's all.
She was great here. Like, I would love to know, like, what was the pitch on like getting this to happen? Like this feels like Safdie's, Fielder, like pulling like favors in somehow. Like, someone knows somebody. Like, just how does this?
Yeah.
How do they appear on the show that nobody's going to watch to like do this bit? I don't. It's delightful. Yeah.
It looks like they recorded a whole segment and everything. Anyway, all right. So later, the couple are having dinner, and Whitney reveals that she's upset that Green Queen is exclusively a streaming show and isn't available to watch on quote unquote actual TV, making it hard for people to find. I found this pretty ironic, considering they're talking about how inaccessible their show is on a streaming service that no one watches.
Excuse me, Paramount Plus, the home of Star Trek. Come on, you can't.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, over the course of this show airing has been like the shuttering of the Showtime brand, right? As it gets in, isn't that, and yes, it's more or less
that is
true.
Correct. That is correct. That is a thing that happened. Yeah. It is now, Showtime is now simply called Paramount Plus with Showtime, very elegantly. And it's a little bit silly. Anyway, and by the way, yes, Paramount Plus does have some good stuff. No, obviously we spent an entire season covering The Curse, so it's not like we have any.
No,
but it's just like, it's probably not one of the top streaming services. They did reference HGTV Go, I think, which is an actual service as far as I can tell. It's their version of an on-demand service. So anyway, but the show Green Queen has been greenlit for a second season. Whitney reveals a new irritation with Kara, who apparently has quit art and started criticizing rich art collectors. And that is the last we hear about Kara on the show, right? Like, that's it. That's the last mention. Kind of a bummer, I think. Like, that one of the first of several things that doesn't really pay off, I think, is Kara decides to not really be an artist anymore, right? Like, and just complain about people.
Yeah, I think on paper, if you were to tell me that's the conclusion of Kara's arc in the show and her relationship with Whitney, that makes a lot of sense for the character. But it is one of those instances where it feels like the grand idea for this episode becomes so all encapsulating that this plot is just sort of written out. It's like it's a fine ending to Kara and Whitney, but instead of seeing it, it's just sort of shuffled off to the side because we need to get to the like predominant, you know, portion of the episode.
It would have been nice to see Kara again in the finale, just because I had gotten pretty invested in that character as the show went on.
Even message, you know what I mean? Like, I think there were better ways to display it other than what feels like a throwaway line.
To defend it, I kind of like it as well, because it it plays it from their perspective of her. And for the most part, her interactions throughout the show is when she has been brought into, or Whitney has forced her way into her orbit. And so we've never really had shots or scenes, if I recall, of her by herself, or not very many of them. And so to have this sort of be like, oh, they're just talking about her casually, offhandedly, it roots us in their perspective, which is the same thing with like the Rachel Ray segment as well. Because even though we're watching it from Rachel Ray's, like the show itself, we are empathizing with Asher and Whitney in that sequence, is why it's so uncomfortable where we sit there for so long, because we're like paying attention to them just smiling in the background. And so like, again, here, it's almost as if she's the background to their own story and just sort of getting shoved off. And you get this resentment from Whitney as well about like, oh, this is like, she's still getting more attention than me for quitting art. And it's just sort of this, again, this trying to centralize themselves and keeping us in that perspective of them while also sort of like highlighting how they're very kind of bitter people in a lot of ways.
Mm. Fair. Asher then shows a present he got for Whitney, a small-scale replica of the house Abshire's family has been living in. The replica represents the couple gifting the house to Abshire. The gesture seems to genuinely move Whitney, but she's immediately concerned about losing money. Asher, however, isn't concerned about going broke anymore because he believes they could survive on love alone. So anyway, Asher and Whitney go to tell Abshire about the gift. He's confused and concerned about who's going to pay for the property taxes. Taken aback, Asher and Whitney agree to pay the taxes. Abshire then pushes further, asking for the property tax money in cash to help his credit situation. Instead of being welcomed into the home and thanked, Abshire shuts the door and the two leave. Let's talk about this whole sequence a little bit. I think this is like very classic The Curse. You know, it's these two people thinking, oh, we're doing this really kind thing for this guy, and it's going to be this big deal. It's going to be this seminal moment in his life. And instead, he's got other things on his mind, you know, and he's doing other stuff, and he has like 50 things he's worrying about. And it doesn't go off. It doesn't come across as they want it to. I want to ask you guys your thoughts on this scene, but I also want to ask, what did you guys make of the fact that there is a guy in Abshire's house? Now, I have studied the tape, and later on in the episode, there is a moment when Whitney they have a contractor at their house, and the contractor accidentally says that he knows that it's a boy that they're having, and one of the he's like, oh, okay, well, you know, I guess we must have accidentally let it slip. And then one of the guys says, well, I'm going to tell everyone. One of the guys jokes, I'm going to tell everyone. I was convinced that that guy was the person in Abshire's house, and that there was going to be some whole like conspiracy about like that guy was in every scene from every episode, you know, like in the background somewhere doing something.
He was driving the car.
Yeah, yeah. But I have studied the tape, and I do not believe it's the same guy. It's actually quite confusing. Because they look extremely similar. I actually am going to send you both a screenshot via text right now. You can see I'm texting you both. This is a screenshot of the guy from in Abshire's house, and then the contractor. The guy in Abshire's house, I think, is quite a bit older than the guy in the contract, but they have very similar beard and facial hair structure. So I was quite confused. Like, was that supposed to be something? And I don't know what that was. So I basically, my conclusion is I no longer think they're the same guy. But if they were the same guy, it would give us a lot more to talk about what's actually going on. This
episode. my interpretation was just, it's a repeat of a theme with the interactions of these three people, which is Ebshire's got his life going on.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Yeah.
Occasionally Whitney and Asher intrude,
yes,
thinking they're doing something kind, like, hey, we've done a bunch of renovations to your house which have increased the value, which then when your property is assessed will increase the property taxes, which means what you owe on a year-to-year basis is going to be more than what this house was before, and when you rent you don't owe property taxes, that's paid by the if I was not as happy with the Kara ending of a subplot. I thought this was a like wonderfully beautiful ending
yes.
to this particular subplot, because it was just an exclamation point on every kind of interaction they have, like writ large, which is like on paper well-meaning, but without really understanding the consequence of those actions and not materially changing someone's circumstances. Like in theory, I guess Abshir can take the cash and then find a way to flip the house, and maybe that can transform his life. Mm-hmm. But if they wanted to transform his life, just give the guy $300,000. And that's not what they did. They kind of put a burden on him that in theory, I think he's going to figure out. And I think the property taxes cash was key to that. But I was like, good for you, Abshir.
Yes.
Like, fuck him. And they're clearly going to roll out. He's at least learned at this point. If you make these white people feel slightly guilty, they'll go, oh no, we better do what you just said. And he just takes that all the way to the finish line in a really satisfying way.
I don't know. I didn't see that as particularly calculated. I saw it as more just he had a bunch of stuff on his mind, and he's like, he's thinking ahead about how this could negatively impact him financially, unless he's trying to emotionally.
Well, I think he's calculated in the moment, is what I mean. I think he's just smart on his feet. Like, I think they kind of, like, I think Asher and Whitney kind of look at like him as like lesser and like needing of help. And it's like, well, his circumstances are just different. Yeah. And he doesn't have the same tools that you do. But when a present is put in front of him, he does know how to unwrap it, which I think is a real testament to him.
Right. And every bit about this is classic The Curse. Like, he's, you know, Nathan Fielder's character saying, oh, you're crying. Nope, that's just dust. dust in my...
He films it.
In the car afterwards, trying to convince themselves that like he took it differently than he actually did. Jesse, any thoughts on this before we move on?
No, I mean, I agree with you both. This is a perfect button on that entire interaction with Abshir. It's just goes to this whole thing where they consistently want to just be praised for everything that they do, and like seeking this validation for like, we are good people from external sources, and just never getting it from anybody because they are not actually thinking about the people that they are helping. It's all about them, and they just want to be patted on the back for it. And that, again, it just not only just a good nice button on this relationship, but just as you said, Patrick, just everything that they have been doing this entire season of just thinking they're doing good but just causing more harm, because it's all really just about themselves.
Back at home, Whitney and Asher are installing climate control into the baby's room, but the rest of the house is still going to be passive. They ask a contractor to hide the panel that controls the AC. I want to pause here and say, I do think there is something really interesting about what happens when basically liberal or progressive ideals collide with reality. Like, this is something that is being dealt with in so many random forms around the country right now. Climate change, crime, there was one other one, housing, you know, specifically housing and how we manage housing, you know, like a lot of liberals are very NIMBY, you know, like they're very like, hey, we love the poor. We want people to have better living situations, but also you cannot build more affordable housing because that means my property value will go down. You know, like there's a lot of conflicts between, hey, I want the house to be passive, but also it's when it's my kid. It's not going to be passive.
And have so you I seen these summers?
80 degrees, that's not going to work. You know, so I think it's just like, that's an interesting tension that the show has continuously highlighted. And I think it's, you know, this is a lovely final bit of highlighting. The contractor presents Whitney and Asher with a baby present, but Whitney informs him they are not accepting gifts before the baby's born. And then that whole interaction happens where, like, they let slip that they know it's a boy. And then one guy's like, you know, I'm going to tell everyone. I think what we're meant to interpret for that whole scene is that guy was joking. It was not interpreted well. And the fact that Asher is willing to fire him shows that he's like kind of not a nice person, right? Like, that was my interpretation.
Especially after Asher has made so many jokes that just didn't land himself. And yet he gets to continually just like fail upwards to a degree. Whereas this guy loses his job for a bad joke that Asher probably himself would have told.
All right. So up until this point, which is we've only talked about the first 20 minutes of the episode, it's been a pretty standard, solid curse episode, right? Like, it's just like, oh, this is exactly what we expect from the curse. And maybe we're going to get some payoff for where the curse is going or all this other stuff. And arguably we did. But, you know, like the tone is very similar to rest of the curse episodes, like the style. And so, and then they go to sleep. And when the two wake up, Asher is mysteriously stuck to the ceiling as if gravity is reversed. And that's basically like how that is dealt with is the rest of the episode. They try to pull him. They try to get Asher. They're convinced that it's because of the way air is flowing through the house, which didn't make much sense to me because I'm like, clearly he's operating on a different gravitational force. I just want to give a quick shout out for how the reveal happened is Whitney wakes up like very slowly wakes up and then she like sees Asher on the ceiling. She's like, what are you doing up there? Like what's going, you know, she reacts extremely realistically to how someone would react to this situation. Let's pause here. What was your reaction to this? Like when this happened, what was your reaction? How did you think this was going to play out? Patrick Klepek, what'd you think?
I did not try to get ahead of the show. doing no theorizing. It might have been around. I think I waited till I finished the episode before I texted you, David. But I finished it and just went, huh. And then I think you were like, I'm dropping everything to watch this episode right now. I was like, yeah. And you're like, what did you think of it? I'm not going to say literally anything about what I thought about it, which you can read into in and of itself. But I didn't know what to make of it. It's, you know, this is a show that it's very, I think it's actually kind of funny that we are about to get a new season of True Detective, in which some of what I've heard about that new season is that it plays differently with the notion of what's actually happening, like, and the idea of the supernatural differently than the way the first season of that show kind of played footsie with it and frustrated some viewers with the answers it had or lack of answers in the end of that first season. And here, that has been a refrain that you and I have gone back on, David, is what is there a nature to this reality, or is the curse merely metaphorical, thematic, emotional? People are more, you know, like it's trauma. Like we aren't sure. And even though what occurs here is a fundamental shift in our sense of reality, physics, gravity, the show still doesn't clearly answer like what's going on. And so I just locked in and was like, okay, this is what's happening now. Much like if you just woke up and the sun was just blue. Well, I don't know. What am I supposed to do about it? The sun's blue now. I go on with my day. And that's how we treated this episode was I genuinely could not tell you how this is going to end. And I now know how it ends and could not have told you that's how it's going to end. And so I mostly just took it at face value. And again, it was sort of in part with my feelings on the show as a whole was I'm willing to go places with this show that seem like it's veering, because if they're veering, I want to veer with them. And that was my thought on it when this shift occurred.
Jesse, any initial reaction to Asher being on the ceiling?
I mean, I have two reactions to it. One, I'll just stick with the literal one because once we finish up, I'll talk more thematically of how I feel about it. But just on a literal level, I found this to be weirdly a lot of fun just to watch this play out. And just again, it's the entire second half of the episode and it's just the complete evolution of it over the course of 20 minutes where like Asher's just trying to like jump around his house. And I love how much it seems to hurt. Like when he tries to like go over to like another room and he has to like jump the lip of the door and he just lands on the other side and flops around and it feels like it's painful. And it's just it actually creates this something that the curse has been very good at, this kind of weird horror to a situation that in despite it being over the top, almost feeling weirdly banal. Like it's just him like trying to get around his house in a strange way and just trying to like grab the phone or use like a vacuum cleaner to grab it and things like that. Like it's just very simple and yet it just creates this very creepy vibe that is more over the top here, but I go back to like the episode where he's like looking at like the camera footage, and there's that horror music playing the entire time, and the very uneasy feeling of that. It worked incredibly well on a literal level for me, that I was having fun just seeing it evolve all the way to the point where he's in the tree, like desperately holding on for his life.
I just want to say, on a technical level, I thought it was all very impressive. Like, yeah. At no point did I doubt that it was Asher being pulled upward gravitationally. Like, I didn't feel like, oh, that's Asher on, you know, that's Nathan Fielder on wires, or there's something else. It felt like, honestly, they had a set that they could like turn upside down and then motion controlled the camera somehow so that they could film him, you know, but then they have them interacting too, which is like wild to consider how they even accomplish that. So I just think on a technical level, it's a huge accomplishment what they were able to do with Asher's gravitational field being reversed, which is not something I ever expected to praise about this show. But yeah,
here
now, on the one hand, I'm thinking to myself, like, I'm trying to think. I don't know if I'm playing into their little game, but like, I'm trying to think to myself, what would I do in Ash's situation? You know, the one thing I wouldn't do? Go outside.
Yeah. No.
Because nothing is protecting me from falling upwards into oblivion.
And it's definitive proof of your situation, whereas where he finds himself, open to interpretation from outside observers.
Anyway. But that said, he's obviously in a very stressful situation. You know, his wife's going into labor, and his gravitational field has been reversed. And so it's like, you know, who knows what I would do in that situation? Whitney begins experiencing contractions. They call the doula to help them out. Asher manages to crawl out of the house, still stuck to the ceiling. The doula attempts to bring Asher down, but it nearly sends Asher shooting into the sky. Asher slips, but is able to grab onto a tree branch and prevent himself from flying up further. The doula leaves with Whitney, but calls Dougie and asks for his help while the fire department makes their way to Asher. When Dougie arrives, he's skeptical Asher is actually stuck, believing it's fear of becoming a parent that is leading Asher to cling to this tree up there. Dougie also recognizes this is a good opportunity for footage and seeks out a drone. Simultaneously, Whitney discovers she's going to need a C-section in order to birth the baby. The fire department believes Asher's just choosing not to come down and sets up a spot for him to safely fall from the branch. Asher tries to explain he needs to be tied to the fire truck, while Dougie asks the fire departments to wire a microphone to the tree branch so he can talk to Asher. They begin cutting down the tree branch, causing Asher to have a full meltdown, at which point Asher ends up flying into the sky, unable to come back down, all while Whitney's C-section happens. Asher continues flying higher and higher into the sky while Whitney meets the baby. Far into the atmosphere, Asher begins to lose consciousness. Dougie's drone operator reveals it's possible to see Asher, at which point Dougie begins crying and indiscriminately apologizing. All right, let's talk about some of the stuff that happened there. I promise you I'm not having a stroke. That is actually what happened.
I felt that way recapping it. You know, it was surreal to watch live, but then as I was writing up this recap, I would type the sentence and go, huh.
there is a great horror movie-esque feel to,
oh, absolutely,
knowing that like Asher is telling the truth, no one believes him, and then you know when they send the person up, the whole time I'm thinking to myself, what is the fire department doing? The fire department, by the way, acted relatively reasonably, I would say, where they probably encounter people who are a little bit mentally unwell all the time. And the last thing on their mind is that this person actually is going to fall upward into the sky. The primary thing is, hey, let's get this person down safely. Very, very reasonable. But yeah, the whole time, like everything the fire department is doing, there's a sense of dread of, oh, they're going to do the wrong thing and it's going to be terrible for Asher. So that was one of my favorite parts of the episode. Really compelling. Jesse, anything about this whole sequence that stuck out to you?
Yeah, I mean, the part for me is just with Dougie, assuming that Asher's having a breakdown because his kid is on the way. It's like, what made you go up there? Because you're like becoming a new dad. Why are you afraid of all that? And Asher just trying desperately to explain what's going on and Dougie just not paying attention and even trying to get the drone for the shot. Again, a nice button on their relationship that I thought was perfect, where it's just Dougie trying to create his own negative impression of Asher for his own sensationalization of the show.
Right. And if he'd listened, maybe Asher would still be alive today, you know?
And again, like Dougie's like, when Asher does float away at the end and Dougie's like traumatic response to that, reasonably so, but it just again echoes the same thing that he did with his wife way back with in when he died in a drunk, when she died in a drunk, his drunk driving accident. So it's again like him not thinking of himself first and not being aware of the people around him. Again, I thought it was a really great button on that. Also just again on just weird science fiction fan in me. It's just like the concept of this is just so much fun. And again, terrifying that he could just fly up to nothing as we see.
Yeah. Patrick Klepek, what were your thoughts on how this played out?
Yeah, I definitely echo the idea that it's a great sort of sci-fi horror conceit. This in many ways feels as though, a Twilight Zone episode has fallen into my episode of The Curse. And then they get a lot out of that. And just the sheer audacity of the concept. And again, that's why I, you know, in the pre-spoiler section was so admired the commitment to the bit, because it's again, very in the same way this show lingers on shots. Like it could have, this could have just been metaphor or dream, and they could have played it for the same, a small amount of horror. And then we cut back to wrapping up the story in a more traditional fashion, and it chooses not to, and goes down the path that it's picked for itself. And like, it's why I sort of separate my feelings on where the show lands relative to the filmmaking and creative choices in the episode as a sort of a singular work, because like as a singular work of like terror and tension, I think it's just like, it's immaculate. Like it's just so, in some ways I would recommend watching this episode singularly and separate from The Curse, because I think it is just an exquisite hour of television. And as you said, David, like, just how did they pull it off? Like, I want to see the behind the scenes featurette, this kind of stuff. They don't really produce that much anymore. Just how did you do this? It's just a really wonderful hour of television. And these sequences in particular, as you're wondering, how are they going? You know, they're not going to get Asher down the way that he wants it to, you know, you sort of know the way this is going to end. It's just a matter of how. And I think there's essentially the last major piece of acting that Nathan Fielder does in the show is that feeling of terror as he's screaming when he knows that he's completely fucked. And you pair that with the acting that he was doing at the end of the previous episode when he's committing himself to Whitney. You know, there's a lot of this show is Nathan Fielder acting adjacent to a Nathan Fielder that we're already sort of familiar. It feels like Nathan Fielder acting, and I'm not doing that to be condescending, but it feels within a spectrum of what we've seen him capable of doing before. And then the end of the previous episode and that sequence of horror in particular really shows a intensity and range of Nathan Fielder that I didn't know the boy had it in him. And he sells how scary this feels for him in that moment in a way that, like, really got to me. It's like, and again, it's real testament to how I was able to be in the moment with the episode, even as I was sort of breaking it apart from my feelings of the show as a full arc.
Completely agreed. I think he really stretched himself. You know, he directed many of the episodes. He really stretched himself. And I always admire when an artist tries to do something that they haven't shown before that they can do publicly. I will say the one thing that really bothered me about this whole sequence was, if I was Nathan Fielder, he was clinging to the tree from above, and just shift it so that you're on the bottom, and then you can show people that you're actually falling upward, my guy. Like then
people might see. He could have separated his hands.
He could have. Well, he was clinging, so he was like, you know, clinging as though he was about to fall upward. But if he just tried to climb to the bottom, quote unquote, of the tree, and just shown that he was, you know, then people would be like, oh, something's clearly amiss here. Why is he stuck to the bottom of that tree. That makes no sense.
And probably would have been more safer for him as well, because at least have something under him. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, the velocity at which he leaves, it's like the pull. It's not right. Gentle. You know, we've used the term float. Floating is the wrong word. My man is shot out of a cannon, like in terms of like the speed at which he leaves, you know, the atmosphere. And so if you imagine the tension that must have on his arms in order to grip, it's no wonder that he doesn't last all that long.
Right, right. Yes, sure. Fair enough. That's a very fair plot explanation. And also, if they did what I said, then the episode wouldn't have happened. So our last shot of Whitney shows her handing off the baby and smiling, looking into the middle distance while Asher floats above the earth. The show concludes with a series of slow shots through Española, concluding with Dougie trying to explain what happened, and some neighbors wonder if it was a stunt for the show. All right, folks, I got two big questions for you. Okay. What happened? And question number two, what did it mean? Right? Like, what was the show trying to say with what was going on here? Jesse, Earl, do you have an interpretation of what happened at the end of The Curse and what the show is trying to say with this ending?
Yeah, I think for me, I mean, I think literally it's sort of showcasing that there was some form of curse that Asher was dealing with. And I think it kind of, what it means to me kind of plays on two different levels. One is it plays on the level of just focusing on the character of Asher in this moment, where we saw at the end of last episode, he sort of like professes like he's going to be everything for Whitney. And Whitney's whole point, as she was saying in the episode that she forced him to watch, was like, I become his whole world. Like, I don't feel like he actually sees me. I'm just this symbol that he's using, that he's like giving himself to and putting on a pedestal. And then his response to that is to do just that. And to just say, I'm going to give everything to you. I'm going to recommit to this relationship by just, again, putting you on this pedestal. And it means he just subsumes himself completely in her and has no real sense of identity in any way, shape, or form. Like, even earlier this episode, he has that sort of like moment where he talks about his Jewishness, and he like says like, oh, well, you're just as Jewish as me, because like there's nothing that invalidates your Jewishness just because you converted after the fact. And she just sort of tosses it off, and like this part of his identity she just doesn't have any association with or even care to like be interested in, really. And I think it's just this weightless feeling to Asher just showcases that he's just a weightless person. Like, everything about him is just, he just has no impact on the world or people around him in any meaningful capacity outside of just being the second person to Whitney. So I think it fits that. And I've been also thinking about, because I was, as we were watching the show, a lot of this is steeped in indigenous culture. And I was sort of thinking, because I was wondering if there were ever going to be like a literalization of the curse. And I think someone from an email was asking about like, what does the curse mean, and have we lost that? And one thing that it made me think about just with that title is, have either of you read the book Ceremony, which is a fairly well-known Indigenous American novel from, I believe, like the 70s, sort of like an influential work. And it deals with a lot of things in it. But one of the elements of it that like was interesting to me when I read it was how the main character of that novel, who's this indigenous man who's suffered a lot of trauma and indignities by living in America, is him trying to understand and incorporate white people into his view of himself and his culture and his history. And one way he was able to do that and sort of try to incorporate into his trauma and how he's been treated and how he views the world is to talk about whiteness as this curse. And one thing that like a discussion on whiteness is just how it's this colonial attempt to sort of homogenize all these cultures and erase any sense of identity outside of like subsuming to the colonialist identity. And so the idea of a curse being overriding this whole series that is very much deep in indigenous culture, and this idea of Asher just being this non-person, just weightless person, sort of ties into this idea to me about how like colonialization not only just oppresses all of these people that, you know, white people coming in with their like attempting to try to like do good for the community, quote unquote, but just ultimately hurting it by trying to fit everything into what they want the world to be, but also not having an identity for themselves and just like losing themselves into the abject nothingness of this like melting pot homogenization of culture, and trying to force everything into that as well. Like we had with the whole like eating the meat segment of like, you just take and you take and you take and you don't even question why. And so I feel like this idea of like Asher becoming this weightless person of just floating away and dying in space, and it being tied to this idea of the curse that sort of loomed over the whole series, just, I think, just ties into that discussion of whiteness and colonialization and its impact on marginalized people, both indigenous folks, black folks, and others, that sort of like just been a through line through the whole series, which was sort of my interpretation of this.
Beautifully said. So the falling upward is this literalization of the curse and all of like Asher's flaws, basically, right? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of why he does what he does, or what happens to him. Happens.
Hopefully that made sense.
that was really lovely. Patrick Klepek, any other thoughts about like what happened and what it all means, do you think?
Well, I'm really glad you had Jesse go first. because this is, so you prefaced this discussion on, we don't have any sense of the discourse. And this is the quintessential kind of show where you watch it and go, huh? And then my first instinct is like, I want to read like a bunch of really smart writing from like a bunch of people. Like, what did you take? What did you make of this? And use that to inform like your broader interpretation of the work. Like it's rare that like so many shows benefit from all that. Like, and I love reading like weekly TV write-ups. Like that's why I like doing this podcast. And so like, this was that kind of show where like absent that, I'm just left to like sit in my own void and go, huh, well, I guess the show is over. I mean, you know, it's not hard to look at, you know, in many ways, what Jesse was pointing out, like, you know, Whitney was extracting from Asher and the presence of this child, the fact that, you know, labor was happening that day sort of represents, well, she got what she needed out of Asher. Like, she's the Green Queen. And now she also has a child. And what does she even need Asher more for anyway? Like, she has sort of started to build this own little kingdom for herself. And, you know, the Jester has gone spinning into space. You know, putting aside how does the world reckon with the act that has occurred?
It would be like if we made first contact with aliens. It'd be like, it's the equivalent of like, oh, a guy fell into the sky forever and was never seen from again. Like, people would be talking about it. It would be like a singular event that would change the nature of how we understand science and physics.
Right. And I think you have to put that aside and like not deal with like what were the practical consequences of this event. And I think that smile, right, represents like some form of happiness, whether it's true, whether it's authentic, it's the version that like Whitney has told herself. And she did this all herself, right? Like, doctor doesn't come in with her. Doula doesn't come in with her. You know, my wife didn't go through C-sections with our two children, but labor itself is a maddeningly lonely process, despite the fact that you are surrounded by people touching you and prodding you and telling you what to do. And she's coming out on the other side of that with a baby and herself and some sense of identity. What that identity is, I don't know. I think the ambiguity there is really interesting because that fits thematically with a show in which it's very hard to pin down who are these people, what do they represent. And so I think the show landing in a place where like Asher's complete lack of like self-identity like results in his like death to some extent, and Whitney's, we're just never really given much true introspection into who she is. Those all feel, again, it's like, it's really in kind with how I feel about the episode as a whole. If you're to describe to me the arcs of these characters and where they end up, it feels very fitting for where we are going.
Right.
I just didn't find the path there and the metaphor or like it chose to get there to be emotionally satisfying in the way that I was hoping.
I think I understand, you know, I feel the same way that thematically each character ends in a really reasonable place thematically, right? Like Whitney is happy. It's like the happiest we've seen her at the end of the show is She has given birth to new life. And as you said, she has gotten what she needs out of Asher. Asher has basically vanished away into oblivion. Dougie is incredibly resentful about his selfishness, his embrace of the sensationalistic and voyeurism, and his inability to look at the needs that were right in front of him. You know, like, each of these characters got the ending they deserved. Now, I do think it's worth reflecting on some of the stuff that we never really came back to. So, for instance, I'm a little bit bummed. Like, we never saw Nala again and her sister. You know, I guess the whole resolution of the casino subplot was just as a plot device for revealing kind of a plot device for like moving Asher and Whitney's relationship along, is kind of my sense. Like, there's nobody
cared to what Whitney's family's like slumlord business. Right.
The slumlord thing. We never saw Whitney's family again. I do wonder, like, to what extent some of those things are like intentionally we left them out, or they just like ran out of budget because they spent so much millions of dollars on making it look like Nathan Fielder was flying into the sky, you know, like, so I am openly or recreating an entire segment of the Rachel Ray Show complete with audience members and so on. Like, and by the way, they really go all the way with everything. Like, they could have done the Rachel Ray thing without showing the audience. They could have done it in a way that like disguised the fact that, you know, like, but they didn't, they wanted to do true to life. I think they show like really graphic depictions of the C-section as well. Like, they, you know, yeah, they clearly made up like a, but they didn't have to do that. You know, they could have just like, hey, here's the baby, but they really just wanted to make everything feel as realistic as possible. And I think that is one of the ways that this final episode has its emotional impact, is the entire show has been filmed in a very, we're using security camera footage way, where it's like, we're just barely grabbing these shots. You know, they're stationary, locked off shots most of the time, observing people from far away. We're like kind of scientific people studying, so that when this moment happens, it is so jarring and discordant in a way that it wouldn't be if this was filmed like a conventional TV show, like the Sopranos or something. And I do think that that is worth giving some credit to, you know, that basically the rest of the show was configured for this whole sequence to be as disruptive and upsetting as possible. The entire rest of the show feels like it leads up to this moment, in a sense. Go ahead, Jesse.
Sorry. The point that you just made me think about with the way they film the C-section was reminding me of how they filmed the different births in House of the Dragon, which in a lot of different ways felt very sensational and very much hyper focusing on like, look at these, look at this like very violent birth that leads to the death of these women, or the harm of these women, yeah, in all of these episodes. And here again, it's played like very matter of factly, and that sort of jumping against like the final kind of line of the show, which is the people around having watched Asher float away being like, oh, what are they doing this for? Oh, for a TV show. Which in many cases is true. Again, just going to that sensationalization of everyday life and just the matter of fact way we see the C-section and her like this birth just played very like documentary, felt very much like it was in line with the message of the show about like how we sensationalize the lives of the people around us and actually don't empathize with them. And tying into Whitney, like, we never get her interiority at any point in the actual, like in the series. The only time I ever think we get her expressing herself is in that segment where she makes Asher sit down and watch it. Like, that's the only time where I think the reason she has Asher watch that is because it's the only time she's ever actually expressed herself truly what she's feeling.
And in the, when she's actually doing the interview as well, we see a little bit of that as well. But we don't really, and then there's this massive time jump too, right? So we don't even, like, it seems like they've kind of patched things up in the interim, but we don't really see what happened there. So,
and I think what's really interesting is, in many ways, there are direct parallels between how the previous episode ends and how this episode ends, in which, you know, Asher turns into not really a partner as much as like someone who will unconditionally love you and support you with no judgment and no real, like, I don't expect to have, like, this isn't a partnership anymore. I am just here to fulfill what you need to achieve what you want. And there are some interesting parallels with having children. Like, children, when they are young, provide you with unconditional love because they don't know any better. Like, you are their entire world. And I don't mean that, like, they don't know, like, kids can't understand your actions, your decisions, what it's like to, like, the power dynamics between a parent and a child, because they don't know what they don't know. And so, in some ways, like, there's something oddly fitting about where it ends, because she has replaced, like, something that you have full control over with another thing that you have full control over. She's just starting with square one with a child, as opposed to, well, Asher, who in many ways is just a man child. And so, you know, emotionally speaking, how different is the newborn and Asher?
And it goes to, like, the same whole thing of, like, she just extracts things from people around her, and she denies that she kind of does it too. Like, she doesn't want to be seen like her parents, who are landlords. She doesn't want to be seen by it as, like, doing harm to this community. She always wants to be venerated, and yet she's just extracting everything from everyone around her, and that's the only way that she can find some semblance of self, is through that. And the only way she can express herself is through this sensationalized media. Because she's also playing a role, and again, tying into that idea of, like, discussing whiteness and, like, what our culture does to many people, and, like, forcing them into pre-described roles that doesn't allow them to be themselves, and just having to be put into these power dynamics that they really don't have any ability to navigate. Like, all of us are put into some level of power dynamic because the way our society is built. I think it all ties together those themes in a really interesting way. So,
any closing thoughts? You know, before we get to closing thoughts, actually, why don't we let people know where they can find more of your work on the internet? Jesse Earle, where can people find more of your work?
You can find more of my work at Jesse Gender, which is my YouTube name, where I do video essay style of stuff. I just did, if you want, a 6-hour essay on Joseph Campbell, the monomyth, Star Wars, and the way we tell political stories today in blockbuster media. You can check out that video. And then I'm on all the social medias as well. And then I'm on Nebula, which is the streaming service that also hosts a bunch of other YouTubers' content, and will be hosting my movie that I'm making that's coming out later this year. So if you like weird science fiction nerdy stuff, that's there for you as well.
That is not an exaggeration, by the way. this video is 5 hours and 48 minutes long.
It is a very long video. It has a whole there's a whole 30 minute, like, Tartakovsky Clone Wars animated segment that we did for it in there. So enjoy.
I thought I was doing good by watching H Bomber Guy's 4-hour video about plagiarism, but there's another mountain to climb.
Yeah.
Patrick Klepek, where can people find more of your work on the internet?
You can find me talking about video games, sports, house stuff over at remapradio.com and wherever podcasts are acquired. And then my Crossplay, my parenting and gaming newsletter over at crossplay.news.
And I want to let people know, again, find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of the show. Let us know what your theories are. I'll forward them on to our co-host. Maybe in a future episode of Decoding TV, we'll talk about them. Stay tuned to Decoding TV for a lot more stuff coming this month and in the next few months. Closing thoughts on the episode. I mean, in the end, I feel like Whitney kind of won. You know, like, that's, and I think we all knew that she would win, and but she got what she wanted, and Asher's out of the picture, and like you all said, she's Green Queen got renewed for a second season, even though it's going to be on HGTV Go, which will be merged with Paramount Plus / Showtime.
I don't know. Space Boy? She might be on actual TV on season 2.
Yeah, that's right. Her husband fell into the sky? Yeah, exactly. And I'm trying to think, was there anything else that, like, was an unresolved plot line. You know, there's stuff that was brought up, but that I didn't necessarily expect them to bring back, like Dougie meeting up with those kids and driving their car into the middle of nowhere. I didn't expect that would come back in any way, but it's just like, who was driving the car at the beginning of, I think, episode 8, was it? Where we see somebody kind of following Whitney almost driving to set. Was that even important? Like,
we spent a lot of time talking about it, David.
that's the question I have, you know, about literally everything we brought up. Was that even important? Like, the guy in Abshire's house, the person who made the joke to Asher in the baby room this week, the fact that the entire series seems to be filmed from a voyeuristic point of view, was that even important? Because we obviously spent a lot of time talking about it, but it's like, you know, even though thematically the show ended in a good place, none of those things were addressed or even didn't even feel like they even thought they were worth addressing. So I'm like, was I silly for even spending time thinking about it? Probably the answer is yes, you know, and I'm okay with it. I'm okay with it. But yeah, any closing thoughts, Patrick Lepik?
Yeah, this is a show of sort of controlled chaos. It feels like it's, you know, looking at it as a total work, feels like it's barely hanging on to itself, like trying to contain all its ideas and what it wants to accomplish. And I don't know, it was a really memorable season of television. Like, I'm deeply glad that I watched it. I can only hope that the folks involved were as happy with the work. Like, I'd love to see, like, Nathan Fielder and Benny Safdie collaborate on something else in the future. Like, the way their two frequencies of creative work, like, riff off of one another is just very unique. There is literally nothing else like The Curse. And if we get nothing else from that collaboration, like, I'm glad we got this, but I'd love to see what they did with another attempt at, like, trying to work on their wavelengths. Like, what would they produce as a result? And I'm desperate. Someone please leak the Christopher Nolan moderating an interview between Nathan Fielder and Benny Safdie that apparently happened as part of a WGA thing. It's not a public bit. Like, I would love to hear, like, what that conversation with life. Like, Christopher Nolan, very serious guy, but also kind of funny and, like, has interesting opinions on comedy, even if that doesn't come through a lot in his work. So just a really interesting work, and would love to see at least these creatives, if not Emma Stone, do something in the future. But if they don't, they made something really memorable. And, like, that's a high bar to clear for as much stuff as there is to watch these days. And I'm glad we got to see it play out.
You know, I do want to say one other thing that I was a little bit disappointed by. And I started going into this a little earlier, but Jesse, you made a great point about how we never really get that much of Whitney's interiority other than when she's being interviewed. And I was disappointed we didn't really see how the results of Asher's plea at the end of episode 9 played out, right? Mm. Asher gives this big pitch of, like, hey, I'm all in on Whitney. Like, it's going to be great. And then clearly they've reconciled and, like, started to build a family together by the beginning of episode 10. But what happened? Like, whoops, I moved my microphone back. What happened? Like, did that go 100% smoothly? Because, like, We don't even know like what Whitney's feeling on Asher is in episode 10. That's kind of my biggest problem with the finale is the all the falling upwards into the sky, like, just takes over so quickly. We don't really get a sense of, like, is she deeply conflicted about this? Is she loving it? Everything's great. That's the one thing that I feel like I'm really bummed we didn't really get an answer to.
My read on that was that she hoped that by showing this sequence, because she couldn't really express it herself, and so she showed the sequence to Asher being like, this is me expressing myself. And then when Asher's response is to just do the thing that she said she didn't want, which is just him just subsuming himself to her, she just closed up. And, like, the beginning of this episode to me just showcases, like, she just kept going along being like, all right, I'll have a baby, we'll get the show out. And, like, it just felt like she went into just, like, script mode where it's just like, all right, there's nothing I can do, and I'm just going to just kind of be dead inside and just go. It just felt like she just went through the motions. And then when he died at the end of this episode, when she extracted everything that she needed out of him, it's like, finally she can be a person, is kind of that vibe I got from it. And so that was great, sort of my impression of it.
But. Yeah, that's a very solid reading. And very smart reading. And I think none of that is like said out loud, but I think it's a very like reasonable reaction to the film. All right, Jesse Earle, you want to take us home? Any final thoughts?
I mean, the only thing that I'll sort of add, because I think Patrick said everything really, really well, I think this is a phenomenal season of TV, and whether you end up feeling like you like the finale or not, I think you'll have a bunch to talk about, as we clearly did. The only other thing I'll add is I want to shout out Emma Stone, because she was fantastic throughout this entire season. Like, everyone was great. And again, Nathan Fielder, like, showcased he had more acting chops than I would have thought. Not that he was ever, I never thought he was bad, but certainly had a lot more range. But Emma Stone just really was the highlight of this entire season. She was fantastic, and I think she deserves any and all accolade she gets for the show. So
100%. All right, I want to give a huge shout out to Patrick Klepek for joining me for the series. Stay tuned to Decoding TV next week. We'll have more news on what is to come. Thank you to Jesse Earle for joining us for today. This is awesome to have your insights, Jesse. And until next time, thanks for listening to Decoding TV. We'll see you later. Goodbye.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.